This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Nearly a year after the Columbia space shuttle disaster, President Bush plans to announce new focus and new goals for NASA. His plan would phase out the shuttle program for new, more robust, and more flexible spacecraft able to send astronauts back to the moon. The eventual target is a manned mission to Mars. The president is expected to outline his proposal on Wednesday, but it's already attracting supporters and skeptics. Democratic Congressman and presidential candidate Dick Gephardt is among the latter.
We've really got to decide what we're doing with the present space program, which is revolving around the space station. I think we need to do a real analysis by our scientific community on what the best thing is to do. I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but I don't know that we can go off on a new moon mission or Mars mission, if that's the suggestion, and just have the money to do something in addition to completing the space station.
Congressman Gephardt spoke yesterday on CBS TV's Face the Nation. So, is he right? Amid budget deficits, a difficult military operation in Iraq, and a raft of domestic problems, how are Congress and the public going to react to an ambitious new space program? We'll talk with a member of the Space and Aeronautics Subcommittee in Congress. We'll also talk about why President Bush is proposing this, why now, and what NASA watchers think. And, of course, we want to hear from you. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll talk about CAPS-2, a reported proposal to develop a computerized threat assessment of every airline passenger in the country. But first, the politics of the moon. Our first guest is NPR senior political editor Ron Elving, who joins us here in Studio 3A. As always, Ron, good to see you.
Good to see you, Neil.
So why now? Why is this proposal coming out now, do you think?
Perhaps there are two reasons, at least. One is that NASA is really in need of having its mission clarified and redefined, revitalized. We need to know what NASA's all about. The shuttles are temporarily grounded because of the Columbia. The missions to Mars have been a little bit hit or miss. People aren't exactly sure what we're accomplishing with that. And, of course, they lack the drama of manned missions. We haven't been back to the moon in about 30 years. So that's one thing. The other thing is that this is a president entering a reelection year, keen on not lacking the vision thing. Now, that's a phrase that his father made famous a dozen years ago, talking about whether or not he was thinking enough big ideas. This is a presidency that wants not to be faulted for having enough big ideas. And this is one of the ways that they're showing they're thinking big.
Well, a return to the moon was one of his father's big ideas. It didn't fly when he proposed it.
Probably he proposed it too early in his presidency. It was 1989. It was the first year he was president. It was one of the things he was talking about doing, but there wasn't that much muscle put behind it, and I think it was dismissed to some degree at the time because the senior George Bush had been a congressman from Houston, and it was seen as more or less somebody who was still loyal to his old constituency, as opposed to someone who was rededicating the nation to a role in space.
It's if you remember back to the Apollo program and Gemini and all those others that went in advance of it, one of the political aspects of genius in the construction of that, there was not a congressional district in the country that escaped having a subcontractor or subcontractor somewhere in its district. So the visor that went on the spacesuit was manufactured right here on our own. Who would likely benefit from a new space program?
Well, certainly Congress and the administration don't lack the imagination to spread the pork, if you will, to spread all of the money that would be spent around the United States. I think they would try to be every bit as clever about that as they were at one time and involve as many people as they could, perhaps even foreign countries, and make it more of a world project than it was done in the 60s, for obvious reasons. And that could be another political masterstroke. I think, though, that a larger problem is that mobilizing the kind of money that would be contemplated for this project is so far beyond anything else that's being contemplated. Right now for NASA, a current budget of about $15 billion, suddenly you're talking about something costing hundreds of billions, granted over a number of years. That's going to require a commitment from Congress and from the general public. That would be much more excruciating politically than, say, 40 years ago when Jack Kennedy was taking us to the moon.
What would be the political price for the president if George W. Bush puts it out there on Wednesday and, once again, it doesn't go anywhere?
I don't think it needs to go anywhere overnight. In this case, we're in the election year of a presidency. We can talk about it in bold vision terms all this year, and that will probably do the president some political good. Beyond that, as long as you have a long enough time frame and a go slow approach, it's possible that there could be some political benefit and not too much fiscal pain associated with this idea for some years to come.
And what they're talking about, at least initially, at least according to the leaks we've all seen, we'll get a better idea on Wednesday, is something like a 5% increase in NASA's annual budget. It doesn't seem overwhelming.
It's planning, it's thinking about it, it's giving them a new sense of purpose, and it doesn't necessarily have to move into hardware or even very expensive software in the short run.
Ron Elving, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Neil.
NPR's Ron Elving, senior Washington editor, with us here in Studio 3A. And joining us now from Beaumont, Texas, is Congressman Nicholas Lampson, a Democrat who represents the 9th District in Texas, which happens to include the Johnson Space Center. He also sits on the Space and Aeronautics Subcommittee. And Congressman, good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you, Neil.
So I gather you're a supporter of the administration's goals.
Essentially, I am. The goal is one that I proposed about 3 years ago into a piece of legislation called the Space Exploration Act. And the intention of it was to push NASA into setting specific goals again, like we had many years ago. And these goals indeed had to do with small steps that would take us to a libration point between here and Moon, ultimately back into an orbit of the Moon, to an Earth orbit crossing asteroid, and then to the surface of the Moon, and then other steps like that going beyond all the way to ultimately to the surface of Mars. So yes, I support what the president is calling for or sounding to call for.
The libration points, for those of us who remember our celestial mechanics, are sort of the top of the gravity well between the Earth and the Moon, a relatively stable point, L4 and L5 are what I think you're talking
about.
Right,
well stated.
Okay.
Full of gravity from one body over the other.
Now, a cynic might point out that Houston is one of the areas most likely to benefit, and of course, that's your congressional district.
That is correct. It would be beneficial to the Johnson Space Center because that's where astronauts are trained, but it's also where a lot of the research is done for long-term space travel, the biological type of life sciences.
Now, every congressman, every senator has projects that they would like it to get done in their district with federal money. This comes under the perhaps unattractive appellation of pork. How do you convince other members of Congress that this particular program is the one that not only your district but the nation needs?
I think the only way we'll be able to do that, Neil, is to hearken back to the times of the Apollo years, the Apollo project when we were going to the Moon, and see what it did to the students of this country, to encourage them to stay in school, to study math and science and engineering, to see what it did to the economy, the spinoffs that we gained that benefited us in our health care delivery, the medical advances that were made, the significant new businesses and industries that were created because of it. The telecommunications industry came. And for a long time, NASA was very proud of saying that for every dollar we spent in space, we got a $9 return here on Earth. I think that's something that we can have again happen to this country. And it was done then during a time of great political strife across the country. We were at war in the 60s when John Kennedy challenged us to go to the Moon. It changed a great deal of that, and it was painful to do. I know that there'll be pain involved in this now. I think it's something that could benefit every American in the same way that they were benefited then.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, TOTN@NPR.org. Let's begin with David, who joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Good afternoon, Neil and Congressman. I was 4 years old when Mr. Kennedy made his speech in 1961, and at various times, probably during the mid-60s, I actually had it memorized, and I could actually do it in Mr. Kennedy's accent.
Good for you.
I won't subject you to it now.
Thank you.
But during 1961, first of all, our commitment to Vietnam had not escalated to the point it was, say, in 1966 or 67.
Right.
And I'm looking at the political backdrop for Mr. Bush's anticipated speech, and I'm saying that as someone who would very much like to go back to the Moon and definitely wants to go to Mars, although I may not go there personally, I don't see the level of commitment from a fiscal standpoint, from the standpoint of financial sacrifice and the ability to, or the willingness to devote that much national treasure on the part of Mr. Bush's administration itself to actually do this. When Mr. Kennedy committed us to do it, it was with the understanding that there would be a great deal of treasure devoted to sending human beings to the moon. And not only that, but again, the ancillary benefits that you've discussed, the increase in technology, the spin-offs, the enhancements to American post-secondary education, all of those cost money. And all of those things have been, frankly, victims of this administration. And I have a real problem with the idea that we're going to do this, but we're going to cut taxes. And that we're talking about $24 billion in 1961 through 1969 dollars. That's what it cost us to go to the moon.
Now, so, David, can I summarize by saying, amidst all the deficits, you wonder about the administration's strength of commitment over time?
I absolutely do, and I really don't think.
Well, let's get a
that there's any there.
Let's get a comment from Congressman Lampson.
Well, I think part of it is going to tell. First of all, I share a lot of what David just said. I wonder how much of this is done sheer for political rhetoric to gain the support of the community across this country that desperately wants us to see return to space exploration to a greater extent. And if you will look at the very first words that were put out by the president back in the middle of December, if I'm not mistaken, about this announcement, immediately we had great expectation of a fairly quick movement into setting goals and into trying to do something in a short term. Then we began to hear very quickly after that we're really looking at very slow movement, that we're looking at being prepared to go to the moon 15 years from now. If those are the kinds of things that he announces tomorrow, then I feel like there is not going to be a great deal of enthusiasm and not a great deal of traction given to his speech. David raises some good concerns. If we're going to truly be successful with this and let it really have the effect on the economy that it can have and on the mentality and the attitude of the citizens of this country, we need to have something that's real meat that we can get our hands on and that we see true increases in technology fairly quickly from it all, or it'll be a bust.
David, thanks very much. And one final question before we let you go, Congressman, and that, of course, is somewhat historical. During that Kennedy speech that he mentioned, a large part of the engine that drove the program was the competition with the Soviet Union. Right. That is now absent.
Well, to some extent it is, but let's pick another nation. The Chinese have just recently put a man in space, and they have a goal to go to the surface of the moon within 5 years, or to go to at least an orbit of the moon within 5 years. That's a fairly fast goal, and I hope that we are not a nation that gets to sit back and say, been there, done that. Let's say we're better than that. We can be there, and why don't you come and join us? We'll welcome you to the moon rather than us following someone. And I think it's important that we get to the surface of the moon for a lot of reasons. There are elements there that can be beneficial to us on Earth. There is an opportunity for us to build a base for true science and true further exploration. There's no reason why we shouldn't be putting telescopes there to look further out into space. No reason why we shouldn't be mining helium-3 and bringing it here for use and for research. And there's no reason why we shouldn't have a base that gives us the opportunity to launch those vehicles that will take us to the moons of Mars and ultimately to Mars.
Congressman Lampson, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Nicholas Lampson, a Democrat who represents Houston, Texas, and sits on the Space and Aeronautics Subcommittee. More on the politics of the moon when we come back from a break. I'm Neil Cohn, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the political appeal of President Bush's new space policy, scheduled to formally announce on Wednesday. Of course, you're invited to join us. Should the U.S. push the parameters of the space program, how much are you willing to spend to see that happen? If you have questions about the administration's goals, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now in Studio 3A is John Logsdon. He's director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. Good of you to join us today.
Good afternoon.
You were on the commission that investigated the crash of the space shuttle Columbia. One of the recommendations it came up with, or one of the policies it really stated at the end, was that the U.S. space program needs clear goals. Is this a policy that the president is set to announce on Wednesday? Does that meet those parameters, do you think?
Yes, I think it does. I think it's very responsive to what the Columbia board had in mind. We said that the lack of a guiding vision allowed the program to drift, didn't tell you what kind of equipment to build, didn't tell you how long to keep the shuttle flying. So this long-range program, as I understand it, really is quite responsive to the board's criticisms.
There's another timing schedule problem, and that is the space shuttle vehicles themselves. They are aging.
Indeed. With all the focus on the Moon and Mars part of this initiative, people don't seem to understand that it includes the space station. Your remarks from Congressman Gephardt at the top of the show suggested that he hasn't looked that closely. The idea is to get the shuttle back flying maybe a year from now, finish the assembly of the space station. It's only 40% complete, so finish the other 60% or some reasonably close to that, and then retire the shuttle sometime at the end of this decade while we build a next-generation capsule, probably, to take people to the station and be able to take people to the moon. So station is very much a part of this, and that means the large money doesn't come until after station is assembled and shuttle is retired. And we're spending, depending on how you want to count, $7 to $9 billion on human space flight now. And when that gets freed up, it can be applied to these new programs.
Now, the heavy lift shape capabilities of the shuttle are required to construct the space station, but once it's done, then presumably it could be maintained and sustained by a lesser craft?
Yeah, to carry the crew and the supplies back and forth for a couple of years until our new equipment is ready, we're probably going to depend on Russian equipment to take people to and from the station, and European and Japanese equipment to take supplies up. So the international partnership in the station, which really forms the foundation for the partnership that the president will propose in this initiative, I think proves its value.
Let's get another caller involved. This is Gene, who's with us from Savannah, Georgia.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the unfortunate political nature of a lot of this, because I think from a scientific perspective, it doesn't make a lot of sense to go to the Moon or Mars that we should dedicate to a larger space station and a permanent presence outside of those gravity wells of the Moon and Mars. And also, just that part of it. And then, if memory serves, 30 years ago, we compromised because of political and budgetary issues on the shuttle when we had a large lift vehicle like the Saturn V, and we could have gone for something that would have just taken people up safely. And I guess the nice thing would be to get politics out of the process and just let it have a little heavier emphasis on the science.
So, Gene, is what you're talking about an expanded version of the International Space Station, or what Congressman Longdon was Lampson was talking about in terms of a more permanent structure at L4 or L5?
One of those. More permanent structure. There's no reason to go spend a lot of energy, and one of the big hazards is getting out of those gravity wells like at Earth. And if we're going to go down into Mars or down into the Moon, other than to mine some minerals or to do the occasional science experiment, there's no reason to set up base there. Why don't we just stay up in orbit at an L4 and L5 point and use that as a launching point? Because then you can really start expanding on the technology to if you don't have to build craft that have to sustain the gravity of liftoff, you can really shift the paradigm and really increase the capabilities to expand out into the solar system and beyond.
John Logsdon?
Well, there are a couple of parts of that. I think that the plan for going to Mars may or may not talk about launching from the Moon. We may well assemble the Mars spacecraft in Earth orbit once we're out of the Earth's gravity well, and then take off from there. As this initiative becomes clearer, I think it will become clear that the Martian part of it is an idea without a lot of details. The moon's gravity is only 1/6 of that of the Earth, and Mars' gravity is 1/3. I mean, if we go to Mars, we're going to have to be able to launch off of Mars to come back anyway. So the real issue is whether the moon is the launch platform for deeper journeys or whether it's Earth orbit. There's no tremendously great advantage of the libration points, although they're very attractive destinations.
Gene, thanks very much. Let's go now with Alan, and Alan is with us from Sherrill, South Carolina.
Hey, Neil, how you doing?
Very well today.
Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
Comment, this is a fabulous amount of money, and we could do so many other things with that. I remember watching Walter Cronkite in the first moonshot, and I was entranced by it and thought it was wonderful, and since then I've really enjoyed, you know, space and all we've done. But we have kids out there that have poor schools. They have no where to get the education to advance this. We need to invest it in our people and, you know, families out there that are going hungry, and that would be a much better place to spend this money, I think.
Mm-hmm. We're all noticing the 40th anniversary of the Declaration of the War on Poverty, which is certainly not one, is it?
Not at all.
No, not at all.
And so what about, you know, this complaint, which is certainly not new to this program and certainly not new to the space program of, you know, hey, we've got a lot of problems here on Earth.
Indeed, we do, and this program is not going to solve them. This is a wealthy country, and it can afford to do, as Kennedy said back in 62, this and the other things, if the money is spent in intelligent ways. I think it's a bit naive to think that if the money is not spent on the space program, it will go into social programs. The funds aren't really that kind of fungible. So I think that this needs to be part of the nation's portfolio. And year by year, it's not that much money. It's not like Apollo, where NASA's budget went up 80% the first year and then doubled again the next year. This 5% a year increases sustained over 5 or 10 years is what the plan calls for.
Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
And joining us now by phone from his office in Durham, North Carolina, is Alex Rowland, a professor of history at Duke University, who is a historian with NASA, and good of you to be with us today.
My pleasure.
What's your reaction to this plan?
There's two problems. That is, I don't think we can afford it, and I think the 5% budget increase, even over 20 years, won't begin to pay for the Moon and Mars missions. But even if we could afford it, it is not clear to me that with the existing technology, it makes any sense to be sending people to the Moon or to Mars. What's the purpose of having them there? If it is exploration, our automated spacecraft can do that exploration much more effectively and much more safely than manned spacecraft. So if we really want to open up space, what we need to do is develop new launch vehicles. To the extent that this plan might include a concentration on development of new launch vehicles, to get a vehicle to do what the shuttle was supposed to do 30 years ago, then we might be moving in the right direction. But until we have that technology in hand, there's no way to predict whether the Moon mission and Mars missions being envisioned will be practical in any foreseeable future.
As if to make your point today, NASA is releasing the first 360-degree panoramic pictures from the surface of Mars that were, of course, taken by the Spirit rover that landed there and has been a spectacular success. And, of course, the timing of that success is playing no small part, we would have to assume, in the timing of the president's announcement. Let me go back to John Logsdon. What goals do you see that would justify the money?
Well, I have a couple reactions to Alex's comments. First, I think the money is going to be focused in the short to medium term on new technology for carrying out these missions. Nobody is proposing that we send people back to the Moon and certainly not to Mars using existing technology. So that's a bit of a red herring argument. The goals are scientific, certainly. There are some, I think it's speculative, that think that there is economic value in being back on the moon and exploiting its resources for a variety of purposes. I think the goals are largely intangible. They are national pride, a sense of motivation, a sense of excitement for the American and the world public. It gives us a sense of frontiers, of openness. And extreme argument, at some point in the distant future, we may be threatened on this planet by the kind of asteroid or comet impact that killed the dinosaurs, and it might be good to have people living someplace else. One more point, automated versus human, no. This is a robotic-human partnership that will do this, each doing what they do best. Spirit is a wonderful piece of machinery, but it can only go a few hundred feet. And it can only do what it's programmed to do. Humans are great at pattern recognition, at reacting to unanticipated discoveries. So it's really the partnership with each optimized for their own capabilities.
Alex Rowland?
Automated spacecraft can go much farther, stay much longer, do much more things, go into dangerous territory, conduct a wider variety of operations than any people can. As soon as you put people on a spacecraft, you change the mission. It's no longer exploration. It's bringing back the crew alive. And all of the expense and all the life-saving equipment and all the redundancy that has to be built in uses up space and weight that could be used for scientific equipment. If you want to do exploration with our existing technology, the unmanned automated spacecraft do it far better than any manned mission can.
Alex Rowland, let me ask you, though, about the conclusions of the Columbia board, and that was that essentially NASA was a bit adrift with all of the rovers going to Mars and all the other things. It was rudderless. This at least is a goal.
NASA has had this goal since the end of the Apollo program of going a manned mission to Mars, and they've been pushing it on every president since President Nixon. And when they couldn't sell the Mars mission in 1969, they settled on what they called the next logical step, was build a space station or build a space shuttle. As soon as you have a shuttle, build a space station. And as soon as you have a space station, use that to go to Mars. They're pursuing the same objective they've been pursuing for 30 years, and it has failed. It does not work, and pouring a bunch of new money at it isn't going to make it work.
Let's hear from Nyaga, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Hillsburg, California.
Yeah, hi, how are you doing today?
Okay.
Great. I would like to point out, I don't know, your people are probably familiar with Robert Zubrin's work. He proposed the case for Mars. And one of the things he points out is that to use a space station or develop one, we have to develop new technology that we don't have yet. And using the Titan and Saturn booster rockets, with current technology, we can actually put people on Mars with a habitat and a fully fueled return vehicle and a rover to bring them back, and you can test it remotely before you even send people out. And it's also two orders of magnitude lower in cost than the current proposal.
These are the same people who told us that the space shuttle was going to be so cheap that it would amortize its development costs in the first 12 years of operation, and this is $39 billion ago. The same people who told us the space station would cost $8 billion were at $100 billion and counting, and we're only 40% done. These estimates of space on the cheap never pan out.
Nyaga, thanks very much. Go ahead.
Thank you.
That isn't exactly fair to Bob Zubrin, who, after all, is an under 50-year-old engineer. He is not the person that sold the shuttle. He's not the person that sold the space station. Zubrin has a very provocative plan called Mars Direct that as your caller suggested, has an idea of how to do this mission quickly and relatively inexpensively. I think there are lots of technical problems and built-in assumptions, but it's a different line of argument coming from different people than shuttle and station.
But we haven't seen an example of any of these pie-in-the-sky promises of cheap manned spaceflight ever come to reality, and I don't think his will either.
Alex Rowland, thank you very much for your time today.
You're most welcome.
Alex Rowland, a professor of history at Duke University. He joined us from his office in Durham, North Carolina. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Peter, who's with us from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Hi, I say all systems go. Okay, I'm a member of the Space Society, Planetary Society, Mars Society, Enterprise Mission. I'm a backyard astronomer. Okay, first of all, we have to build hardened structures on the moon for strategic defense initiative, because if you put those battle stars in orbit, it's liable to countermeasures. The Chinese have a rocket that can go around the Earth and put a man in space. It can lob hydrogen bombs on us, okay? Now, we need we can build in orbit Project Prometheus, which is a nuclear engine, or the Project Orion, which is a nuclear pulse engine that fires 1 kiloton charge against a pusher plate, and we can get to Mars in 2.5 weeks at 3% of light speed. All right, there's no screwing around. We can get it up in orbit by Lockheed owns the Russian Energia rocket company. That's a big thing, like the post Saturn V Nova class. All right, we can get to Mars. We can do all this research. Two-thirds of our robotic probes have crashed and burned on Mars, and they're a waste of money. When you get men there, they stick a flag in the ground and they do the job. They have the right stuff. Robert Zubrin did not. Who's in the Mars Society did not sell us the shuttle, and I am tired of wasting money on these socialist welfare programs of these handout people. It's parasitical. I want my money spent on the best and brightest science. I want spin-off of technology for every $1 we put in.
I think we get the point.
$23 back in technology.
Peter, I think we detect your enthusiasm for the project. Let me ask John Longston. I mean, is there a national security aspect of this?
Well, it was spoken like a true space cadet with a funny mixture of practicality and wild ideas. No, I don't think the moon is the next high ground in national security terms. The travel time for intercepting or basing a laser on the moon, if you want to use the speed of light, makes it a really terrible place to base weapons. So this is done for national image. This is done for national pride, but not for military security.
Here's an email from Philip Hansen in Lakewood, Ohio. The federal government could raise money for the space program by starting a national lottery, the prize of which would not be money, but a ride into space. This might be the best way to capture the imagination and the support of the general public. I'm not sure about that, but I think this is a number of interesting ideas, and we'll await the president's speech on Wednesday when we'll get a better idea of what the administration is actually proposing. John Longston, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
John Longston is director of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C. After the break, the latest on the government's plans to do security checks on travelers. Airlines may be ordered to hand over all of their passenger records, and you may be color-coded when you fly. If you'd like to talk about it, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.